our first text for Life in Text this week, and we're recording now, is from a guy by the name of the Maor Einayim. So my usual text is kind of a compendium book that I like to use. But this, the Maor Einayim, is I shy away from him because he's really difficult. He tends to be long-winded and complex. I was comparing him, if any of you are music fans in the Hasidic world, to the band Phish. The Grateful Dead is another comparison, but Phish is more specific than the Grateful Dead in the sense that Phish, when I listen to Phish, I really enjoy it, but I also, it's lovely, but they never go anywhere. They just kind of wander around for 12 minutes and then it ends. And that's the Maor Einayim. He says beautiful things. There's never a killer line. Dave Matthews Band, Rich has out there. Dave Matthews, they put out a whole album of just 5-minute songs though that come to a conclusion. But Phish, they have what they're called, there's Baker's Dozen, which is a concert series they did at Madison Square Garden. They did 12 shows in 12 nights and they never repeated a single song. But that meant that they did 18-minute improvisations where clearly everyone on, Phil says there were 13, where they were clearly just absolutely going off. And it's beautiful music, but it never ends anywhere. So, oh, Baker's Dozen, Phil, thank you. All right, so, but that's the Maor Einayim. He's a brilliant chassid. He's very interesting. He kind of floats around, man. He's just kind of out there and he kind of says beautiful things and they don't always kind of come together. So this one's an interesting one. We'll take a look at this text and I hope you enjoy it. So this one is on your screen right now. It starts with a text and I'm going to relate it to our Torah portion. This is a Parshat HaShavua class. It's just that this week it'll be weird. So this week is a double portion in the Torah. It's Parshat Behar Bechukotai. Behar is because the opening verse is, and God spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, Behar Sinai, on Mount Sinai. And then the opening of our section of Torah deals with the question of, or the concept of the Shemitah year, of the sabbatical year in which the Israelites plant and grow and reap their harvest for 6 years in the land of Israel. And in the seventh year, they don't plant and they don't reap. They let the land go fallow, or they let the land grow naturally from what was already dropped from the year before. And anyone, not even the owner of the given field, but anyone can wander through and pick the food. So the sabbatical year then leads into the concept of the Jubilee year. The Jubilee year is the seventh year of 7 years. So 7 times 7 is 49. So in that 50th year, there's a big Jubilee for the land, which has a couple specific laws to it. They're mentioned in another place in the Torah also. The basic rules are slaves that weren't otherwise released are released. But most importantly, when the land of Israel was apportioned to the 12 tribes, the land was then individually apportioned to each individual family within each tribe. Every 49 years, if you gambled away your portion of the land drunkenly one night over poker, and you become a tenant farmer on someone else's land for the next 30 years, in the 50th year, of this Jubilee cycle, the land reverts to its original owners, meaning you get your land back. And the whole reminder in both Shemitah and Yovel, which is the Hebrew word for Jubilee, is that the land doesn't belong to you anyways. All human beings are temporary residents. We're all renters. None of us are owners. Because as we say in the Hallel prayers at the holidays, Vadanai ha'aretz umla tevel v'yoshreva, right? The land and all that is in it belongs to God. It's not ours, it's God's. So that's the whole opening of Behar. Behar then jumps into some other stuff. Then Bechukotai is something I didn't even bother to look at this week. So, because when we do the triennial cycle, there's so much good stuff in that first third. I generally want to go to it unless it's terrible, and then I don't go to it. So the Me'ori Naim, the Rabbi Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl, it's hard to say three times fast. Menachem Nachum says, he starts off by commenting on the seven of sevens, right? He does it in a pretty random esoteric way. And then he links it back to the fact that we're in the counting of the Omer right now, one. And two, he links it to the fact that the counting of the Omer is a seven of sevens also, 49 days. And that the counting of the Omer links up Passover and Shavuot. So there's two holidays, the number seven, and there's also the number eight, which is the holiday of Passover in the Galut has 8 days. And then he's going to kind of riff on the whole concept of holidays. So again, very much like Dave Matthews Band, Grateful Dead, Fish, which is there's an idea, there's a theme, we're going to go far afield from it, okay? So he goes far afield, and he immediately starts by quoting something from Ecclesiastes, which is related to this idea of seven and eight. And he says this, Ten chelek l'shiv'a v'gam l'shmona, ki lo teda ma yihye ra'a al ha'aretz. Distribute portions to seven or even to eight, for you cannot know what misfortune may occur on earth. So then that's the lead-in from Ecclesiastes, and then we're going to have his text. So take a look at the Hebrew in that box. I just want to call your attention to it. We've had this a couple weeks ago, months ago, but I want to call your attention to it again. If that looks like weird Hebrew and you can't exactly read that, that's because it's in what's called Rashi script. Back in the day, printers in the, I think, 13, 14, 1500s decided that if we put Hebrew next to other Hebrew in the same font, people might confuse the words of Rashi for the words of Torah. And God forbid we think that something that wasn't from Sinai was actually mistaken for something that was from Sinai. So they created their own font. That font is so weird that some of the letters are absolutely unrecognizable. So if you look at some of those letters, you may not be able to tell what they are. The difference between a tzadi and a lamed is the difference between the top of the lamed looking like this and the top of the lamed looking like this. There's a couple, the aleph is actually basically a chet wearing a little hat, like a little pokey hat. It's really hard to tell. So for me, I've gotten accustomed to it. It looks like Hebrew to me. It doesn't bother me at all. It also has no vowels, because why would you give anybody any help ever? It's no problem for me, but I just wanted to call your attention to the fact that this book was written in a slightly different script, which is kind of cool. If Paula doesn't mind, Paula, would you mind reading the first paragraph, which is in the little box where it starts Rabbi Yehoshua? And remember to unmute yourself.
Okay. Rabbi Yehoshua said, seven. This is the 7 days of Pesach. Eight, this is the 8 days of Chag, Sukkot. For on Pesach, we perform the mitzvah of burning our chametz. This is the mystery of the destruction of the klipot and the revelation of the drawing near to the uppermost holiness, that this is the time of becoming free from the klipot. On account of this, the 7 days draw one's divine elements near to their roots for one that is wise and knowledgeable of its ways.
Okay. There's about a bazillion things that just happened. So pulling this apart, this is one of those really deep texts that needs a lot of pulling apart. So first of all, he makes an immediate move, a fun move. The I'm a rabbi, I can do what I want kind of move, which is he sees the number seven and eight in Ecclesiastes and says, well, he's not just pulling numbers out of, the Torah is not pulling numbers out of a hat. Seven has meaning and eight has meaning. What is the meaning of seven? There are 7 days of Passover. And what is the meaning of eight? If you add Shmini Atzeret, which we call Simchat Torah, in Israel is synonymous with Simchat Torah, but in the Galut, it's actually the ninth day, then eight is the holiday of Sukkot. So he just there linked up with one verse in Ecclesiastes, two of the three pilgrimage holidays, right? The pilgrimage holidays when pilgrims would walk from all over Israel with their sacrifices to the temple at Jerusalem. The oddball in this holiday, in these three pilgrimage holidays, is Shavuot. Okay, so Shavuot in Israel is a one-day holiday, and in the Galut, in the rest of the world, it's 2 days, right? So we have a holiday that's 7 days. We have a holiday that's sort of, depending on how you count it, 8 days. It's also, Sukkot is directly connected also to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which come right in there. And then you have Shavuot, which is a one-day holiday, right? And that's super weird. So he kind of try and draw them all together. So the first thing he does is he says, on Passover, we perform the mitzvah of burning our chametz. So he makes immediate spiritual move. He's like, all right, what's a holiday? What makes a holiday a holiday? So all the things that you guys said, we gather, there's community, we get off of our devices and enjoy the world, right? It's special, it's from God, which was a nice move that Paula made, which is going to be close to our text. It's separate, which was what Marilyn said. It's separate from the normal, right? We have regular, we have something different. So all those ideas, he has a slight riff on that idea. On Passover, we burn chametz. So what is burning chametz? Why do we do this, you know, thing? Are we just mad at the chametz? Is it like, you know, are we trying to make sure we get rid of it? Yeah, sure. By the way, this year in Israel, they did not burn chametz. I don't know if you heard about this, but because the burning of chametz in Israel is really communal, it's a very public thing. People take big oil drums and light fires, and people from all over the neighborhood come and throw their fire in. I don't know if you guys have seen in past years, probably, but Sherith Israel on Murray does the same thing too, and we've done that too. For a donation, of course, a suggested donation of $18 for them to light something that you probably could have lit on your backyard on fire, but it's good. It's for a good cause. But it can't be just, we're going to burn this stuff. So in Israel, they canceled the burning of chametz this year. And so that people didn't congregate and pass the virus off to each other. But there's gotta be something deeper, a deeper mystical reason for burning the chametz. And so for the Maori Naim, he basically says it's actually an allusion to a Kabbalistic ceremony or a Kabbalistic idea, which is, this is a cool thing that if you've ever had a Tu B'Shvat Seder, you kind of know. So the Tu B'Shvat Seder is the Seder that is celebrated in February for the birthday of the trees for Tu B'Shvat. At a Tu B'Shvat Seder, you have four different kinds of food. You have fruits that have a peel, which you have to peel off to eat. You have fruits that have no peel, but have a pit. Fruits that have no pit and no peel. And you have fruits or nuts that have a shell or covering. So four different kinds of fruits. I may have gotten some of that wrong because I mix these things up sometimes, and I haven't done a Tu B'Shvat Seder in the last couple of years. But in the Kabbalistic understanding, fruits and nuts that have an outer husk are a metaphor for our own connection to the divine, which is to say that the world has that which is unessential, which is the outer husk, but is also the material that we see, right? Everything we go through in life that is physical or is visceral, but not emotional and not spiritual, is an outward husk, right? You go to your job, you do data entry into a computer, you do the spreadsheets, you make the phone calls, you send the emails, you come home, right? That is the world, but it's also like material and mundane and boring. It is not holy, but you've got to do it, right? It's the husk. It's the outer piece of the peanut that you don't really like, but you got to do it in order to get to the peanut, right? And then there's the inner stuff, the good stuff, the meat of the orange, the meat of the peanut, the essential part that's really great and core to existence. And in the Kabbalistic understanding, that was divine. And that is like either the Shefa, the divine light, or it's a sense of the essential or the ruach, the light, the spirit of the divine. So there's a spiritual world and a physical world, and the physical world is an outer husk. Another way of looking at the klipot, the outer husk, is that it's bad. It's bad behavior, it's bad things, right? Sometimes in the Kabbalistic world, klipot are crappy things that we engage in our lives. Like sin is the klipot, and we burn it just like we burn chametz in order to rid ourselves of our failings and our misfortunes. All right, I'll pause there in case anyone has a question. I'm just taking a time. So klipot is a shell or an outer husk in the Kabbalistic idea. If I remember to, I'll throw this into the glossary later. Okay, seems like everybody's cool and on board with me, so we'll keep going. I know this paragraph's a little weighty, but you're getting the deep mystical secrets, guys, and for basically free. I mean, you know, what could be better? So he keeps saying, this is the mystery of the destruction of the klipot, the revelation of the drawing near to the uppermost holiness, right? So in order to draw close to the supernal light that is God, you have to unweight yourself of the husk, right? You can't wear the suit of armor to fly up to heaven. You've got to be unweighted. You've got to be unbound. So you've got to get rid of the schmutz, the outer layer, in order to draw closer to what he calls the uppermost holiness. Kiruv HaKadusha Elyona, right? The highest holiness. And we've seen this kind of language before when we talked about the angels and Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. So this is a constant Kabbalistic refrain of like getting higher, getting closer by getting rid of the things that weigh us down. And he keeps saying, and this is the time of becoming free of the klipot. So all of our answers about what makes a holiday holy, for the Maori Naim here, he's talking about it being an opportunity to draw closer, right? We burn the chametz. It rids us of the outer husks. It lets us get to the core of spirituality, which draws us closer to God, right? It's all about practices, acts that get us closer to God, which is really neat, I think, because to some degree, it calls upon a lot of the different things that people talked about as we opened up by kind of thinking, I need to draw close to God, and I need to do something differently as we get closer to this holiday in order to do it. Finally, he says, on account of this, the 7 days draw one's divine elements nearer to their root. So he says, you get closer to the Shoresh. So another mystical idea that we're going to see, I'm going to scroll down so you can see that it gets name checked later, is this little line right here that I'm highlighting, which says from the Zohar. I had to go diving through the Zohar for this class again, which was always a challenge because it's really hard to find things. The pagination that the text gives you and the pagination of my Zohar are not the same. So I have to go through pages and pages and pages in order to find where anything is. So he says, the Zohar says, every Israelite citizen will sit in a sukkah. Everyone whose root and trunk is holy of Israel will sit in the shade of the faithful. We're going to come back to that. But there's this concept of shoresh, and I forget what he uses for trunk, but it's basically, oh, geza, that's the word, geza. So there's this idea that connection to the divine, and we're outside so we can take a look at this. Connection to the divine mirrors a tree. God is the shoresh, the root. And to get to the shoresh, we have to cleave to the trunk, right? You gotta get closer. We are kind of like the branches and the leaves. And to know God closer, we gotta get down into the trunk and then down all the way into the roots. So that's the concept that he brings up here. He says, on account of this, one's divine elements, we draw closer to the root for one that is wise and knowledgeable of its ways. So a person who engages in prayer and study and mystical practice during the holidays will draw closer to God, right? you'll get who we are, which is kind of the outermost parts of the tree. And we want to get down to the innermost part of the tree, which is the core of it, and is the life-giving element, the root. It's also unseen, right? So calling God the Shoresh, the root, as a metaphor for a tree is a beautiful metaphor, right? God is the Shoresh, the root. It's below ground. You can't see it. It provides nourishment to everything else. And we want to get closer, right? The water is drawn in through the root. Great. Okay, we're going to keep going. Marilyn, you are going to read the next paragraph, if that's okay with you. And it kind of jumps the page a little bit, as you see. It says, starts with 8, and it ends with the line, the Holy One, blessed be. Go ahead and unmute yourself, Marilyn, and read for us. Just a paragraph.
Can you just make it a little bigger?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I have the power to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. 8. These are the 8 days of Chag explained above, that on account of the mitzvot of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, God spreads over us a shelter of faithfulness as we draw our divineness to the Holy One, blessed be.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. So from there, we've got this interesting idea. I'm making it smaller again so I can read it. I hope, I think, maybe. Technology. It's difficult for all of us. Okay. Maybe a little bigger. So here he jumps into Sukkot, right? And now he's going to do a big mystical move again. So this is a tough, meaty text. Some of you are like, I love this. And some of you are like, Rabbi Goodman is just rambling incoherently nonstop. Like I said, it's like Fish or the Grateful Dead. 8. There are 8 days of Chag. So he's riffing off of that 7 and 8 that was above. That on account of the mitzvot of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, he's drawing those 3 holidays together, as we often do in the tradition, God spreads over us, pores sukkot shalom aleinu, right? God spreads over us a shelter of peace is a verse that we read in Ma'ariv. But here it's God spreads over us a shelter, a tzila of faithfulness, of what's the word that he uses? I have to find it. A tzila de mehem nuta. Atzila dehem nuta, which is Aramaic from the Zohar. And it's a phrase that I'd never seen before. And it's a shelter of emuna, of faith, whatever that means. So at this time, there's this understanding from the Zohar that God gives us this sukkah, right? And what's the meaning of burning chametz? We're burning away the klipot in a Kabbalistic nature. What's the idea of a sukkah? We're sheltered in God's shade of faithfulness. So God builds, we build a sukkah, but the sukkah is not really a sukkah. The sukkah is a mystical structure that connects us to the divine. That's all it is, right? We burn chametz to get ourselves closer to God. We build a sukkah to get ourselves closer to God. And we don't know exactly how this is working, but there's mystical things working on another level that make this happen. And again, it's drawing closer. It's drawing closer to the Shoresh, to the root. So it's getting weirder and weirder. Dee, do you mind reading for us the next paragraph?
I'm I'll lie more. So Shavuot, that is a day of which the Torah was given, that one cannot draw closer or give over the portion of themselves to the Creator, blessed be, more than on this day. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are times to be stirred to higher tshuva, as has been explained.
Okay, so he does this cool move, which when you're right before a holiday, it's always nice to promote the holiday by saying, this one's the best, which I love. So this holiday coming up, all the more so Shavuot, which is called Atzeret in his text and in other texts, which literally means the holiday of gathering. That it is the day in which the Torah was given. This is the big day, man. One cannot draw closer or give over a portion of themselves to the Creator more than on this day. So everything is kind of leading up to this moment. So we burn chametz. It reminds us of the klipot, which is a way of getting closer to God. We build a sukkah. It reminds us that God is all around us in faithfulness, in emunah. But Shavuot's the holiday where all 600,000 of us stood at the foot of Sinai and directly beheld the presence of God. Shavuot is the holiday that commemorates a personal one-on-one or one-on 600,000 meeting of all of our neshamot, all of our souls with the divine. Nothing is bigger. This is the Super Bowl of holidays, which is funny because he kind of throws in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and says, ah, these are about tshuva. They're nice. But, you know, Shavuot is really the holy, holy holiday of all of them. We don't need lots of mystical language in order to understand how we get closer here. All right, Rich, you're up to read, if you don't mind. Don't forget to unmute yourself on account of Israel's drawing closer, and you can read all the way to the bottom of this page.
Okay. On account of Israel's drawing closer and God's drawing down to us, the divine showers holiness and blessing. The core of these days is the acquisition of holiness from above, and God sanctifies the days that these are the times for Am Yisrael. That is the explanation corresponding to Rashi when it says in the Amidah, who sanctifies Israel in these times?
Great. That's the last. Okay, you're good. Sure. Oh, you want to read the Hebrew? Go ahead.
Okay, whatever. Yeah. Mekadesh Yisrael ve'he'azmanim.
Ve'azmanim. So this is a thing that in services we do at the Musaf Amidah in the Kedushah. And everybody who ever leads services knows this line really well because you have to get the music right or you screw everything up. So Seth and I are really, you know, we nerd out about this line. It's Mekadesh Yisrael ve'azmanim. Amen. Right. So Rashi says that that line, who sanctifies Israel and these times, is special, and it corresponds, and we do it for the holidays because it names checks the holidays. The Meori Naim, the Chernobyl Rebbe, is throwing in here that God uses holidays, these zmanim, these times, to come down, to draw closer to us, shower us in holiness and blessing. And we use these holidays to create practices that draw us, for lack of a better term, up, right? Holidays are about getting closer to God. They're times that we mark out to say, 365 days a year, I live in God's world. I pray all the time. I study Torah all the time. But these days, I'm going to spend more time focusing on my relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, with the Holy One, blessed be. And I'm going to think about practices that draw the holiness of God down to me and draw myself closer to God through them. So it's a neat idea that, like, there's, and we use all the things that you guys mentioned, gathering, community, getting off of devices, right? Recognizing that we're separate and we're special. We use all that as a conduit, as a vehicle to draw closer to God. But it's mostly about the drawing closer to God. That's why you put a fish in your dishwasher, D. You make the dishwasher fish for the relatives, not because it's the best dishwasher fish that anyone ever made. You make it because it will eventually remind you how to celebrate the holiday to draw closer to God. Okay. Dishwasher fish, everybody. Try it. Okay.
You done it yet?
I'm waiting for the opportunity. Shavuot is the dishwasher fish this year, I think. All right. So finally, it finishes with, truly Israel is sanctified along with the days because of the drawing near of the portion of the chelek to its root, to its shoresh. So the other piece that he finishes with, and here's your kind of bumper sticker line from this class, is that we are a chelek, we are a portion, and God is the root. That we are a little portion of godliness in the universe. I think that's the nice little idea here that he kind of finishes on. By the way, this is one chunk of a 7-paragraph piece on holidays. I only gave you the piece that I thought was most interesting. But he kind of concludes this paragraph by saying, we're all just part of God, right? We're all just wandering around as part of God's universe. And we are, in order to connect to God, we just remind ourselves that we were never apart anyways. We're actually always part of the divine. We're a chelek of the shoresh. We're a portion of the root. And that's the Meori Naim. Okay. And I just will reread this line for you that he name-checked before from the Zohar, that every citizen will sit in a sukkah, and everyone whose root and trunk is holy of Israel will sit in the shade of the faithful, that the sukkah is the shade of the faithful. All right. With that, I'll take a pause and let anybody who has any thoughts, reflections, comments, or complaints about our text kind of riff and throw in, like, how did this one strike you? What do you think of this rabbi's conception of holidays and holiness? Everyone's waiting for someone else to talk. Did you like it? Did you not like it? Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, so actually my question was a side question about Shavuot. Did it represent a gathering at the temple in the old days? And if so, how did it jive with it being today, the celebrating the Torah? I guess I don't quite understand today versus yesterday.
It's a great question. Almost all holidays in Judaism have a weird, I can't think of too many that don't have multiple purposes. They have a weird mix of a biblical reason and either a second biblical reason or a rabbinic overlay. And Shavuot is a great example of that. So Shavuot is really the celebration of the festival barley harvest that was then tithed at the temple. So the three pilgrimage festivals were practical for the priests because they were three times at which people would bring their harvest, the fall harvest, the spring harvest, and Passover was an early spring harvest or the winter wheat, and you could bring in all your bounty. So they were kind of like jumbo market days, right? So that was what they meant back in temple time. Go ahead.
Most of these festivals had an agricultural root.
That's right. They were a harvest festival of a society that was 95% agrarian in nature. Right. But when Judaism moves away, away, away over time from being agrarian, right, we become more focused on other reasons. And also many of them have dual purposes. So Shavuot is a holiday that's aligned up with the giving of Torah at Sinai. And there are various ways in both the Torah and by the rabbis making some moves in order to line those two holidays up. Go ahead, Eli.
I'm fairly confident that putting giving the Torah with Shavuot is purely rabbinic, and it's not in the Torah. And the Torah just has Shavuot as a harvest holiday. And then the rabbi said, well, obviously, it's this many days after Pesach. What happens 7 weeks after they leave Mitzrayim? Well, that's when they got to Sinai and got to the Torah.
Right. Well done. I'm pretty sure, too. I think they did it just through math. They figured it out. Shavuot follows this far off of Passover. That's how far it took to get from Exodus to Sinai. I'm not even sure that the days line up. I think that point of 49 days is purely rabbinic. 49 days from there to there, 49 days from there to there. Therefore, it happened at this time. Another example of this, by the way, is the holiday Rosh Hashanah. You probably all know this because you know from going to services and hearing Rabbi Adelson say this, but the words Rosh Hashanah never appears in the Torah. It's Yom Truah, Yom Zichron Truah, or it's the first day of Tishrei, which is the ninth month in the calendar. It's never Rosh Hashanah. So the rabbis threw all sorts of stuff together in a blender. Sukkot was also an agricultural holiday, which gets thrown in with also the Exodus and the building a little hut as the people went on their 40-year trek through the desert. They kind of speedball those two ideas together too. So it's pretty common. Any other questions about this funky mystical text or any comments about whether you dig it or you don't dig it? Audrey, go ahead.
I kind of have a question about why he would get into this at all. I mean, maybe I should ask Joe, it's his ancestor. But why would he start with this? It's very clever, and it's a great way to I guess, you know, unless he's doing it to make a speech to somebody, why bother?
That's good. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. I think I looked at a couple other texts, and sometimes I think that a pivot to a mystical text is an opportunity. So one of the basic ideas that we've talked about in Hasidut is that mystical literature before the time of the Hasidim was always understood as, it's not for you, right? You're not smart enough to understand this. We have to keep it hidden from the masses. And I'm a very strong proponent of democratization of text. Nothing makes many Jews, particularly me, more angry than seeing a school district ban a book and say, you aren't capable of understanding this book, so we're not going to allow you to read it, right? I just saw a school district in, I think, Missouri banned Catch 22. And it's like, why? I mean, all you tell a kid when you say to them, this book is not for you, that kid wants that book all the more so, right? And that's mystical literature for the Hasidim. The Hasidim were, people had told the rank and file Jew, you're not smart enough or mystical enough to understand this. And the Hasidim said, damn it, you are smart enough. You're good enough, you're smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like you, to quote Saturday Night Live. And you can do this. So maybe this is partially about making public a text of the Zohar, because it was generally thought, you know, the average Jew on the street wouldn't be capable of it. So if any of you ever like, I don't understand this, you know, the rabbis sometimes wanted you to not understand this, and you should be mad at them for that. This is the Maori and I am doing the best he can to make it more accessible to the masses. Any other comments on this text? Nice. Okay, we're going to go on to the bumper sticker text now. These ones are shorter and pithy, and you can put them on a bumper sticker. They're also sweet and nice and lovely. So we're back. Oh, wait, before I share the screen, I'm going to unshare the screen now that I've shared the screen. I want to show you where I got this book. A couple weeks ago, I saw this book mentioned, this guy, the Maimonot HaNetzach, mentioned in our other book that I like to use. And I was like, who's that? I looked him up and I was like, oh, he's a dude who lived in Israel until he passed away in the mid-1980s. And he wrote this little compendium of thin little volumes. And I wasn't having any luck in our other book finding anything compelling. And I went into this one and I just hit pay dirt. I found three cool, quick bumper sticker texts, which were really lovely, that I'll share with you now. So we might actually finish on time today because these are quick, but for those of us who care about finishing on time, because we all have so many places to go. Yes, I've been to Giant Eagle like 17 times during the quarantine, and I'm tired of going to Giant Eagle. I'd like to go somewhere else at some point. Okay, so text two is on this verse in Leviticus. So when we finish with the stuff about the sabbatical year and the Jubilee year, there's a random mitzvah thrown out, and it's kind of random in a good way. V'lo tonu ish et amito v'yirata me'elohecha ki ani Adonai Elohechem. A person must not wrong their fellow. You're going to have to pay attention to this. In Hebrew, the word is amito, and it's with an ayin, okay? But fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. So we get three little comments on this. Comment number one. Rabbi Eliezer of Meitz, who was a contemporary of Rashi's grandson, he died in 1175, said this, just as one can harm another person with words and slander, so too one can harm another with an evil eye, that one shows a face of ill to their fellow. This is a really neat little teaching, right? The question is, what does v'lo tonu ish et amito, don't wrong your fellow? So he, interestingly enough, we already know you can't do this, right? The Torah is filled with examples and stories of ways in which you cannot be a jerk to your fellow. So why bring this mitzvah here in a vague, non-specific way? Rabbi Eliezer of Meitz says, you cannot, we have a one thing in the Torah which says, don't go a talebearer amongst your people. Another mitzvah that says, do not slander another person. And he basically says this mitzvah of don't harm another Jew is an elaboration on that to a deeper level, right? Just as you should not harm another person with words, so too, don't even give them the evil eye, right? Someone pisses you off and you're in a meeting and you just give them the stink eye, you know, you're just like, Dave, why would you say that? You know, you don't say anything, but you're like, you make a face, right? Or deep in your heart of hearts, someone does something or says something, this Karen lady that you cannot stand, and you just wish the evil eye on her. In your mind, in your heart, in your face, you're just thinking, oh, Karen, one of these days, you're going to get hit by a bus crossing the street, and I'm wishing it upon you, right? Rabbi Eliezer Metz is like, don't do that, man. Don't do that. And that's what his understanding of lo tonu ish et amito is, right? Do not oppress your fellow human being. Don't wrong them. Don't even give them the evil eye. So when Karen says something really obnoxious, hold it in, man. Hold it in. Don't put the evil eye on her. All right. The next teaching we get is from one of our favorites, Simcha Bunim of Pshischa. And Simcha Bunim says this, what is a chassid? The person that goes beyond the letter of the law, lifnim mishurat hadin, right? So a regular Jew is a person who observes the 613 commandments, but doesn't, you know, try and like be extremely careful or punctilious about any given one of them. A chassid is someone who gives extra caution to each and every law. They try and fulfill a commandment to the absolute nth degree to make sure that they are extra careful. So I wouldn't even say anything that might be perceived as harmful to another person's feelings because I want to go beyond the letter of the law. Simcha Bunim said, a person should not wrong others. This is the law. Lo tonu et ish amito, the verse that we just had above. Going beyond the letter of the law, lifnim mishurat hadin, that one should not wrong themselves. Right? So a person, it's very easy. This is very similar to a teaching we've seen before in the Hasidic world on Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. In order to love your neighbor as yourself, you must love yourself, right? Yeah. Simcha Bunim says, much as you need to go beyond the letter of the law in order to not wrong others, you need to not wrong yourself. So this is good coronavirus Torah, I think. I am always distracted right now. I am never doing the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. The dishes are always in the sink. The garbage always needs to be taken out. The kids always need to get on to another Zoom call. I'm fairly certain that Iggy missed a 1 o'clock Zoom call because I was here teaching. But yesterday, my kids missed 3 Zoom calls because I had to go to the grocery store because we had no milk, we had no bread, and we had no eggs. So I either have to feed them or I have to educate them, and I can't do both. I either have to study Torah or I have to get my kids onto another First Schlugener Zoom call, and I can't do both, right? I either need to weed the garden or do the dishes or take out the garbage or talk to my wife. I can't do all of them, right? I am not good enough 100% of the time. That is coronavirus for me. My kids need something, I need something, you need something, we need something, and that need is never met. Once we get out of the coronavirus quarantine, we will still have this problem, right? We will still always be in a situation where we will be a failure, right? I've been writing this book, I'm like 3 chapters behind right now. Am I giving myself a break? No. What does Simcha Bunim say? Damn it, Rabbi Goodman, give yourself a break. Do not wrong yourself, right? Don't lo tonu et ish et amito. Don't oppress, don't wrong, don't harm yourself. Take time for spiritual self-care, right? Rabbi Marquise is huge on this. He talks a lot about finding ways of taking care of yourself. It is one of the reasons why I am not worried about what I'm cooking and baking during this time. The other day, I went to the store and I was like, we are buying more chocolate, and I am getting 2 more pints of Ben and Jerry's, and that's because I need these things. Do not wrong yourself, right? You need to take care of yourself, and you need to take it easy on yourself for all the things that you're getting behind on or you're not accomplishing. One of the other things I love to see on Twitter is that a number of people on Twitter have basically effectively said, you know, you've got weeks and weeks and weeks indoors. Maybe this is the opportunity for you to write the great American novel. And the counterbalance to that is, damn it, this is not the time to write the great American novel, right? This might be a really hard time for you. Don't beat yourself up about the things that you have not done with the time that you had. If you binge watched a lot of things on Netflix instead of writing the great American novel, that's okay, right? Don't beat yourself up. Okay. And then there's one other line that he adds in here. Moreover, a person needs to be fervent in having awe of heaven. As it says, do not oppress, ... and have yirat Elohim, have awe of your God. This is a term we talked about a couple weeks ago when it came to, we talked about yirat shemaim, fear of heaven or awe of heaven. So it kind of connects it back that not wronging yourself is also being in awe of the divine, right? God created you as you are, love yourself, all right? Final line, the big payoff bumper sticker line is one of the greats, and this is completely unnamed, which is really interesting. One of the greats of Hasidut added on this verse, Velotonu et ish amito, a person must not wrong the truth, amito with an Aleph. So I said above that the Hebrew of this verse, lo tonu et ish amito, do not wrong your fellow, is with an ayin. Here, it's flipped to an aleph, and that would spell the word emet. Emet in Hebrew is truth. A person must not wrong the truth of themselves, since an ayin can be exchanged with an aleph, is the end of that line. So I'll finish by kind of riffing on this line and reflecting on it. I think this one is mind-blowingly cool. To thine own self be true, is what Marilyn would probably say here. She's our great literary scholar. That's Shakespeare, I think. And the idea being, you have a personal truth. You have your own truth in the world, and you have got to not wrong your own truth. You've got to be yourself. You can't be something you're not. This is also a very like free to be you and me, Mr. Rogers Torah. Someone name checked Mr. Rogers in chat before. You've got to be true to the truth that is you, right? You can't be something you're not. It's really important for you to find your own truth in the world and to live it out and to be that truth. And going against it is a form of oppression of yourself. So be yourself and don't hide from who you are. Don't hide from what you are. Find your truth and seek it out and go towards it. Do not oppress the truth that is you. All right. With that, any final thoughts or reflections?
That's like to your own self be, wait a minute, I forgot the quote. To your own self be true.
Yes. Shirley, did you say who that is?
I think it was Hamlet.
You think it's from Hamlet. Thank you, Audrey.
I could say something. Do progressive rabbis tend to use that last line that you said when discussing the issue of homosexuality?
You broke up a little. When it comes to the idea of what?
Homosexuality.
Oh, to thine own self be true?
Yeah, does that ever come up in during those? I'm sure there's just everybody can use a text for everything they want in that type of discussion, but I'm just that one to me, that's immediately what I think of.
It's great. It's a great point. I've never seen that text before in my life. This is the first time I've ever seen this concept of going towards your own truth. A homiletical reading by an unnamed Hasidic rabbi on a verse that says, do not oppress your fellow. Is a long walk to get but I mean,
probably was not his intention.
Right. I don't think a Hasidic rabbi would come out in favor of homosexuality, but the way liberal rabbis often explain homosexuality, they usually use a pretty strong verse, which I use it often, and I've never gotten a satisfactory response. The concept that it occurs in God creating us in God's image. And then there's a line in Sanhedrin, in Mishnah Sanhedrin, that says that God stamps each and every coin as an image, a mirror image of God, and yet no two coins are alike. And so the idea there is that God creates us intentionally the way we are. So the response that people often give regarding homosexuality and Judaism is, if God created me and God created me exactly this way, and God created me having sexual and emotional desire for people of my own gender, how can I then turn around and deny that by pretending to be something I'm not? And of course, in the ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox world, they have an easy answer to that, which is, well, it says you can't do that in Leviticus, so you can't do that. But for the rest of us, we would answer in the liberal world, they were writing that the Torah was written in its time, reflecting that line.
It would probably also say you haven't found your true self yet. You're still finding your truth. That's probably what somebody would say if you were like, this is me. Why? How could it possibly not be?
Right.
They'd be like, well, maybe it's not really you. So
right. You have to be true to yourself. You have to be true to yourself.
Right. A traditional understanding of it is basically for homosexuality that you should suppress it. Because the tweak of all of this is, like, you could take the idea of be true to yourself to its logical extreme and say, well, my true self likes eating bacon and, you know, getting tattoos and violating all 613 commandments, committing mass murder, you know. But, you know, so there needs to be still at the end of the day a symbiosis and a synthesis between the Jewish person seeking truth and higher forms of spiritual elevation while also pursuing their own truth. So truth is also to be taken in conjunction with Torah guidance, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have one more thing I wanted to share if I can.
No, please.
Going back to the original, I happen to be a fan of Fish and the Grateful Dead and lots of jazz and lots of music with very long songs and kind of esoteric stuff like that too. So I'll say this, the fish analogy, I like it. But my counter analogy is that it's not that they don't go anywhere, that they don't go where the casual listener might want them to go.
Nice.
Which really still applies to the Zohar or whichever text you were quoting, is that if somebody would be like, well, it's not that they don't go anywhere, it's just that maybe you're not ready to go there yet, or maybe that's just not where you want to be. Anyway.
I think that's great. I think that's great, and I thought the analogy was perfect. I've been to a Fish concert, and I really enjoyed it, but you don't listen to Fish the way you listen to other bands, right?
No, you don't.
You don't know what you're listening for, and you probably, if you have a favorite song, you probably know they're not going to play it. They might play it, but you may have to come back for the next 3 days.
Yeah.
And they're not going to play it the way you last heard it. You know, they're
also the only band I know where those that are like the biggest fans really don't like their albums.
Right.
So it's like, you know, and I'm one of them. I mean, I've been listening to them since I was 13, and their studio output, it leaves a lot to be desired, but that's not why I listen.
Yeah, my sister brought home the album first when I was young and said, this is a great band and everybody's talking about them and they're great. And she loved this album. And she thought it was great.
Yeah.
And their big song was this song, Fee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really stupid song, you know. It has one of their more famous songs is called Susie Greenberg. And the reason it's called Susie Greenberg is every once in a while they just blurt out, Susie Greenberg! And then they play a whole bunch of more jazz, basically. And then they yell out, Susie Greenberg! Again. And it's... That's the Maori Naim. He's kind of out there, and he's going in directions, and you are either with him or you're not. So,
yep.
I don't know. It's a good analogy. All right, guys. It was great seeing you all. You could stick around and say hi to each other. I'm going to turn off the recording.